This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be talking about some cinematographers of Star Trek in the modern era. But before we get to that, I guess there's just a little bit of news in relation to some Star Trek people.
Yeah.
A couple things. One, Jason Isaacs, I guess, incurred the wrath of fans or something.
Yeah, he's a little scamp. He basically said he didn't care. He said what is sort of underlying a lot of these conversations about people being upset about Star Trek Discovery, where he essentially said, I don't care what the diehard fans think. They're going to watch anyway.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Yeah. And I saw that and I was like, oh, that makes sense. You know, I'm like, because that's something which I've said a million times before. Like, you know, they're going to, you know, I mean, just from a business standpoint or whatever, they're not selling it to the diehard fans because all the diehard fans are going to watch. And apparently the diehard fans took offense to that. I don't know. Were you offended? Yeah.
No, I'm not offended at all. Because the thing is, all they need the strong first episode. They need the strong pilot, right? They know the diehard fans are going to tune in. They need to be able to market this pilot to get the casual fans or the people who have left Star Trek or never been fans to come in. And they've obviously got enough confidence in what they have done that Kurtzman's already talking about a season two. Mm-hmm. Like, he is confident that this is going to be a hit. And, I mean, part of that can just be an exec producer, you know, bluff and bluster sort of thing. But, you know, they just need enough people to tune in and be happy with the first one. That's it.
Yeah. You know, but obviously there were, you know, people complaining and upset and, you know, sending mean things to Jason Isaacs in response. Even William Shatner chimed in at one point, like, oh my God, you said that? And I don't know whether that was like a, no. Oh, I've been down that road before, or whether he was quietly judging him. But I'm like, really? The Get a Life guy is going to be?
No, okay. I really think that Mr. Shatner was saying, oh, I know what you just did. I mean, because I was there for the reaction to when he had the Get a Life bit. Like, right. When it aired live and pre-internet, he caught a lot of flack for that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I don't know. He gets it. I mean, I tweeted that I care about Jason Isaacs caring about diehard Trek fans about as much as Jason Isaacs cares about diehard Trek fans. I mean, really, it's like, I mean, maybe people are upset because of like a respect issue, but I mean, to me, it's like, he's a guy who's doing a job.
Right.
You know, I've had jobs where I've done things that I don't, and he's not even saying that he doesn't care about it, right? And he clarified his statement to say, like, you know, it's not that I don't care about the fans, it's just that I'm not worried about, you know, sucking them in, you know?
Well, I mean, the thing is, if they sit there and they obsess about whether they're going to please the diehard fans, which in a sense is an impossible thing to do.
Yeah.
There is going to always be a certain core group of fans that's impossible to please. And, you know, and that's fine. That's fair. That's whatever. You know, like, we all have found ourselves on that side of the debate with some franchise somewhere along the way. And, you know, there are people that are the Marvel Comics fans that still can't be pleased by the movies. And there are people, you know, it just is. And I think that you know, I mean, just the larger point of like, if they sit there and they obsess about it and they're like, oh gosh, can we do this? Because it might upset some diehard fans. They're never going to get anything done. They're never going to make anything fun or experiment. Like, they're there. Like you said, he's a guy who's got a job. He's an actor, and his whole job is simply to play what he's given well. And if he sits there and wonders, well, the way I delivered this line might not go over, or the way they wrote this might not go over, you're just going to wind up spinning in circles the whole time.
And, you know, that's the other thing is, like, since Star Trek is such a continuity-based show and all that stuff, and since there is so much history to it, if, let's say, the, you know, content creators of this series were to come out and say that, I'd be like, huh, okay, well, that's maybe a little concerning, right? Like, if the writers started saying that or something. But as an actor, right? I mean, there's plenty of actors who right. are really, really good at acting, even if they don't care about the material that they're... And he's not even saying that he doesn't care. You know, he's saying that he doesn't care about the reaction of the fans, the diehard right. fans, because, like, almost from, like, a marketing standpoint, you know? So, I don't know. To me, it's a big, you know, whatever about nothing, you know? Yeah. I'm way too busy being offended by everyone else than to be offended by what Jason Isaacs has to say
yeah, right. there
about
you go.
Star Trek, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's a whatever. And it's, I mean, more interesting to me was the revelation of the reaction of the first six episodes from, as Ted Sullivan said, Dr. Wife. Mm-hmm. Her reaction to the first six episodes were, if somebody didn't see the tweet, one, that's the show. Two, show me the next one. Three, run. Four, I love him. Five, OMG. Six, are you kidding me? So it definitely sounds like we don't know exactly what the show is yet. Like, yeah. I think that's a really great tease on his part, because he's like, you all think you know what's going to happen, but you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, definitely true. You know, when I saw that, I was very excited because, you know, it's reaction from someone from the outside. And I mean, sure, you know, I mean, she's connected to one of the key creative people behind the scenes, but still, you know, she wasn't doing this publicly or anything like that. So it's exciting. You know, it's exciting. We're so close, and there's six yeah. episodes in the can. That's mm-hmm. exciting too. I can't wait. It's right yeah, around the corner.
I'm getting excited, man. I'm getting really, really excited.
I was watching Colbert last night on actual real TV, and
there was.
I know, right? I was at my parents' house. You know, they're old. You know, whatever.
okay, makes sense.
But a commercial came up for Discovery. It was like kind of, I hadn't seen it before, but it was like a bunch of sort of like panning close-ups of Tecumseh, and then it like pulled it with like Tecumseh in character. He wasn't speaking in Klingon, he was speaking in English, but he was, you know, talking about, you know, whatever, like, I am a guy who has done these things and these people will feel my wrath, or, well, you know, I don't know what I honestly have absolutely no idea what he said, but it was like
yeah,
one of those
things.
We got
the gist. Yeah. We got the gist. Yeah.
And then it ends on like a close up of his face and it's like, oh yeah, Klingons. I don't know. It's cool. It's cool to see yeah. it. You know, it's like, wow, this is actually a real thing. And they're actually showing like commercials to like regular people.
An ad, well, I think the Colbert's audience might be their sweet spot to begin with. But,
yeah.
you know, in all honesty, yeah, there's a Star Trek ad on television.
Mm-hmm.
How long has it been? It's been a very long time. I mean, yeah, we had Star Trek Beyond ads, but, like, this is a thing now. We're going to see Star Trek ads regularly for a time. That's cool.
It's cool, yeah. Just a few weeks away. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, in the meantime, let's talk about, you know, visually speaking, I guess, how we got here over the past few years. one of the things which we've discussed here and other places at great length is the visual style of Star Trek and how, you know, maybe over the course of the franchise's history, there were some high points and some low points in terms of, you know, innovation and visual style and all that stuff, and how, you know, maybe they fell into the rut of weekly television and kind of stopped doing things which were innovative in the ways that the original series were innovative and that sort of thing. And how, in my opinion, you know, one of the reasons why I love Abrams' Star Trek so much is because it really pushed the visual style into the 21st century, you know, really. It sort of brought it up to modern standards in a sense. And we thought it would be cool to look at the three cinematographers from the modern era, you know, first with J.J. Abrams' cinematographer, Dan Mendel, and then Justin Lin's cinematographer for Star Trek Beyond, Stephen F. Winden, and then the cinematographer who's responsible for creating the look of Discovery with the pilot, Guillermo Navarro. And we're going to be talking about three of their films, which, I don't know, I think represent sort of high points, in a sense, in their careers.
Yeah, sure.
So we'll go in chronological order by cinematographer, not by film. So we'll start with Dan. I never know if it's Mendel or Mendel.
I'm pretty sure that if he wanted to come on and give an interview here on Stage 9, we would welcome him to correct the record.
Okay.
But in the meantime, I don't think anybody's going to hold it against you.
Okay, so we'll say Mendel, I guess, even though I usually say Mendel. I don't know, whatever.
I'll probably say Mendel. I can't help it.
All right, we'll do that then. Anyway, Dan Mendel, he shot tons and tons of things, most of J.J. Abrams' movies, including Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. But to me, the one that always stood out, the first time that I noticed his work and was like, wow, this guy is amazing, was a Tony Scott movie from 2005 called Domino. Now, John,
I had not seen it before this. I had not seen it. I've always been a Tony Scott fan in the sense that I'm not like a diehard fan that's like all about Tony Scott sort of thing. But if I saw his name as a director, it was like, oh, cool, a Tony Scott movie. And I think the first time I fell in love with Tony Scott actually was True Romance, because I think that stands. That's a wonderful, wonderful film. I think it's one of Tarantino's better scripts handled by Tony Scott in his own way. But Domino sort of like blew my mind, because visually it is just like the movie as a whole is interesting and it's well performed and it's got a good pace, it's got a good feel, and I enjoy it. But visually, wow, it is crazy good just how it works. And like you sent me an article after I watched it, talking about how, you know, Mendel was using like a hand crank to work certain aspects of the camera so that they could get a certain look for certain things, and they were doing all of this experimental stuff. But it really does create an imprint of, no matter what you think of the whole package visually, the film really sticks with you.
Yeah, for those people who aren't familiar with it, because it is one of the more obscure Tony Scott movies, this is a movie which, as it says at the beginning, it's based on a true story, sort of.
Yeah, sort of.
Domino, the main character, refers to Domino Harvey, who was a woman whose father was Lawrence Harvey, the actor from The Manchurian Candidate. And she grew up, you know, in sort of like Beverly Hills high society, and basically completely rejected it and decided to, instead of going down the route of becoming a model, which, you know, she was sort of being, groomed for in a sense, she instead decided to become a bounty hunter and actually became, I guess, sort of the protege of that guy who has his own reality show and everything. Is his name Dog the Bounty Hunter?
Yes, he did have his own. Does he have a show again? He made some unfortunate comments that lost him his show for a time.
Yeah. So this movie is based on that, but it's not supposed to be the story of Domino Harvey in terms of like some sort of historical document or whatever. It's more of a super crazy, amped up version of events. You know, it's taking the spirit of Domino and translating that into a fictional movie, in a sense. And it stars Keira Knightley as Domino and Mickey Rourke as a character, which is not Dog the Bounty Hunter, but is supposed to be, you know, and loosely
based on him.
Yeah. And there's a ton of other people in it. And it's written by Richard Kelly, the guy who, you know, wrote and directed like Donnie Darko and stuff. And it's absolutely insane. And one of the things which always stood out to me about it was the editing, really. Like I'm constantly impressed by how this thing is cut together in this very sort of like fractured way, and it's very sort of like abstract in its storytelling and everything, and you know, rather confusing at times, but also really, really solid, and sort of creates, in my mind, like an experience more than anything else. It's not necessarily about, you know, the narrative. It's more about being thrown into this world. And one of the ways that it does that is through its photography. So,
yes.
I mean, I don't know. Visually speaking, like, there's lots and lots of crazy stuff going on here. You mentioned the hand-cranked cameras and stuff like
that. Yeah.
And that creates, like, a lot of weird effects, like, you know, images slowing down and speeding up at various, you know, rates, you know, in the middle of shots, you know, flash frames and everything like that, because obviously if you slow down a camera, then you're exposing the film to light for a longer period of time, you know, so you get these flashes and stuff like that. But the other thing that they do, which is really, really interesting, is they use this sort of, it's called, I think, ektachrome film, which is like it's a reversal film stock. So like normally when you shoot film, you come out with a negative, right? Well, here you come out with a positive. Like literally the image you see on the film once it's processed is what you get. But they do this thing called cross-processing to it, you know, where they basically, instead of when they're processing the film, instead of processing it like it's a positive film stock and using the chemicals which you would need to do that, they process it like it's a negative film stock. And by doing that, essentially you're, you know, getting a different chemical reaction, and the result is a very unique looking image, which has like lots of pastels, lots of greens and pinks that are just like super, super vibrant, along with like a lot of grain. And as they were describing in that article, like when you do that, it's such a, I don't know, chaotic process that you never really know exactly what you're going to get. You don't know what the film is definitely going to look like. You're really, you know, sort of leaving it all up to chance. And this was a big thing back in the day. You know, there were a lot of movies which sort of used this technique. Josie and the Pussycats comes to mind. An Inside Man by Spike Lee, which was shot by the guy who shot Josie and the Pussycats. You know, like there's a number of movies that did that, and they look fantastic. And, you know, Kodak kind of going out of business or whatever it is they're doing, you know, they stopped making this stock for, you know, a few years. Like, I guess Domino would have been like one of the last movies to actually use it, but they announced a short while ago that they're actually bringing the film stock back, and a lot
of
filmmakers.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, a lot of filmmakers are really excited about it. It's, I mean, for people who I don't know, for those who may be, you know, like amateur photographers, or were back in the day, what this stock is almost literally is slide film. You know how like if you were to, you'd have to buy special film in order to make slides. The reason for that is because slide film is a positive stock. So like what they're sticking in the slide is actually the physical film that you shot. So that's what this is. It's the same thing. So
I have a question for you though, because I Kodak's bringing back the Ektachrome and everything like that, and it's sort of like the vinyl versus MP3 versus cassette tape sort of argument. Does Domino exist in a time where people are shooting digitally? Are there techniques for digital that could give us this? I mean, you're not going to hand crank a digital camera, and so is Domino almost like a testament to what we're losing with the transfer over to a different technology?
I think it is in a lot of ways because, I mean, yeah, you could say like lots of these things could be replicated on digital, but I think, you know, what you're doing there, which is something, you know, there's always the debate of film versus digital, and my you know, thinking has always been like they're both good, but what you shouldn't try to do is make one look like the other, which, I mean, that only goes one way, really, is trying to make digital look like film. You know, if you're going to be doing that, you might as well just be shooting on film. And certainly you could try to replicate the look of Domino through the use of color timing and various other techniques. And the end result would be, in my mind, something which is kind of generic, because one of the things which I think makes Domino so distinct is the chaotic aspect to it. You know, the idea that they don't even really know what it's going to look like exactly, you know? Whereas if it's planned out from the beginning and you say, I want this part to be bright green, I want this part to be pink or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, obviously they have a pretty good idea, but you don't know for sure. It's too many variables to actually, you know, calculate this stuff. Like, you really sort of like lose the organic, you know, feel of the movie. You know,
sure.
And not to mention, you know, like a lot of the decisions that they're making in terms of like the hand cranking and stuff like that are things which are being done on set, you know, in camera. I seem to remember reading an article back then where they talked about how they would even do like double exposures on this thing, you know, so like, you know, generally speaking, if you see, you know, two images on top of each other in a movie, it's like a dissolve, you know, like they shot one and then they shot the other and then you dissolve the two together in, you know, post-production. But what they did in this movie for a number of scenes was they would film one thing and then rewind the film and then film the other thing on top of it, you know, which creates a much different type of look.
Yeah.
And also gives you absolutely no options in post-production, so you're sort of like giving in to the randomness of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's exciting to see how they did this, and I think if they were to try to replicate this specific look in digital, it would be way too sterile. Now, I think that there's other things that you can do with digital cameras in the same spirit that, you know, would be able to get this feel across, even if it would look absolutely nothing like what this movie looks like. You know what I mean? But
sure, yeah.
You can, you know, adapt this philosophy to a different medium, but the results are not going to look at all like this. They're going to look like something which is completely different, which is fine, you know, but I'm glad that there's the option, you know, and Mandel is someone who, like, I think he's actually flat out said, he's like, if you want to shoot a movie digitally, like, I'm not your guy because I basically don't know anything about that. You know what I mean? So it's cool. It's definitely a cool looking movie, you know?
And but just as a quick point, though, like if he's saying, if you want to shoot digitally, count me out. Is he basically, is he basically acknowledging that he's going to be part of that bygone era? Because it's eventually all going to be digital, isn't it?
Oh, there's a lot of people fighting against that, including, you know, his director, you know, on Star Trek, J.J. Abrams, who is, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, well, maybe he's not the most influential voice in this thing, but he's one of the top three, I think, for sure, because he's the guy making the new Star Wars movies, you know, like that type of thing. Like, you know, if you've got the director of Star Wars saying, I want to shoot on film, then that gives, you know, the film companies, or Kodak in particular, a lot of pull in the industry, you know, in order to sort of like keep them around, you know. So, sure. I mean, I don't think that he's willing to, I think he's going to be someone who's fighting this until the end. If it does happen and film does go away, I'm sure he would switch to digital because, you know, you got to do what you got to do. I'm not sure if he shot anything digitally before. I know he talks about like almost all of his movies are anamorphic 35 millimeter. He's the guy, he's the reason why he got those lens flares, you know, but whatever, you know, Domino is one of the few movies he shot, which is not an anamorphic, but it still looks great. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it does. And I think we've pretty much expressed to everybody that if you haven't seen Domino, it's well worth seeing.
It's
just
awesome
for the visuals. But I also think it's worth seeing because I think the ending is a pretty brilliant because I made reference to True Romance. I think the ending is basically like Tony Scott recapitulating the end of True Romance and saying, well, if I did it this way and changed a couple of factors, how would it look?
Yeah.
And I think it's a great, like, it's a great, like, reimagining of the end of True Romance.
Yeah, they're very similar in terms of the endings. But the beginning of Domino, I think, too, is absolutely amazing. Just what happens in the first 5 minutes before the opening credits, you're like, oh, my God, I can't, what? And now that, oh, my God, like, it is the craziest stuff you will ever see in a movie. And then you just get to it, and then, you know, it ends and leads into this opening credit sequence, and you're like, oh, my God, we've been through all of this already, and we're just getting to the opening titles right now? Like, that's, yeah. It's insane. It is such an adrenaline rush. It's so great. You know, check it out. Don't go into it expecting your typical movie at all. Just, you know, let go and you know, give in to the experience of it all. Crank up the volume as much as you can, and I don't know, you'll love it or you'll hate it. I mean, it's one of those movies which I'm sure a lot of people, I mean, I remember like when I saw it, you know, my grandpa would always used to call me up and say like, okay, I want to go see a movie tonight. What should I go to see? You know, and I'd always tell him, you know, oh, go this, or that. So he called me up one day and he's like, what should I go to see? And I'm like, go see Domino. It's amazing. And he comes out of it, oops, and he's like, that is the biggest piece of garbage I've ever seen in my life. I'm like, okay, well, whatever.
Just to prepare, I think a good way to also sort of prepare your expectation for the sort of ride it is it's sort of like Any Given Sunday.
Yes.
In terms of how it comes together.
Yeah,
where
definitely.
It's like at the end of it, I wouldn't be surprised if some people's reaction is, what just happened?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're just in there and then it's over and you're like, huh, well, that was what happened? And you have to think about it for a minute. I definitely think that's going to be some of the reaction.
Definitely. All right. So that's Domino. You know, I don't know. This has always been like, I mean, when the movie came out, I talked this up like crazy. No one went to see it. It's one of those movies which very, very few people see. And when you try to get people to see it, they're kind of like, I don't know, man. And then after they see it half the time, they're like, I don't know, man. But Oh, I know, man. This movie is amazing. I think that this is the best edited movie in the past, I don't know, 15 years or so, in my humble opinion. And I think that the photography is every bit as good, not to mention like the performances. Keira Knightley is amazing in this movie, and so is everyone else. And you never know who's going to show up, whether it's, you know, Christopher Walken or,
yeah,
you know, Tom Waits or Delroy, yep, Lindo or whatever. It's fantastic. I cannot recommend this movie highly enough.
I agree. And, you know, if you see it and you don't like it, you can just chalk it up to me sort of going through Stockholm syndrome of podcasting with Mike for so long. And my tastes are finally changing, I guess.
I don't know. Let's... I think you just are someone who can recognize quality when you see it. So,
I try.
Yeah. Well, it's been fun talking about Domino today, and we'll get to those other two movies further down the road. But that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Meta Treks.
I don't like to have too much time, Zachary, to sit and contemplate, because I do sometimes end up second-guessing my decisions. But that...
Second-guess your whole life if you let yourself. Yeah, you know,
absolutely.
That's not good.
Absolutely. And honestly, that is a recurring theme, I think, in this season.
Standard Orbit.
Well, I think everything comes back to the naked time for him, and he just can't get away from swords.
Running around with a sword.
He's just running around with a sword. So maybe it was this episode that started that whole thing, but man, yeah, it's kind of an odd thing that he's defined by a sword in his hand, you know?
Literary Treks.
Oh, Matthew, I'm doing just fine. You know, it's always fun every week to hop on here and talk Star Trek books and comics with you. And I don't know if you realize this, Matthew, but this is our 200th episode of Literary... Wait a minute, Matthew. We don't host this show anymore.
And introducing The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
But if I ended up missing an episode, I would record 45 minutes of blank space on my VHS tape, and then I would wait until it came around, and then I would put the episode in its proper order.
This explains so much.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on the iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most other third-party apps. And you can also stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to get in touch with us. The best place is to join the larger conversation on the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we should come right up. Or you can find us on Twitter at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me as Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And over on the Nerd Party Network, I'm on Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing. And I'm also on Great Shot Kid, a look at the technical and inspirational side of Star Wars filmmaking with you, Mike Schindler.
Yes, you can find me over there on thenerdparty.com. Or you can also find me on commentarytrackstars.com. Doing a show called Commentary Track Stars, or you can find me on TalkFilmSociety.com doing a show called Soderbergh 2828, where we look at all of Steven Soderbergh's movies, and that'll be ending on Monday with our review of Soderbergh's last movie up till now, Logan Lucky. So head on over there and check that out.
Now I'm looking forward to Logan Lucky. I'm just going to say.
Oh, me
that
too. I'm going
great.
Tonight. I can't wait. It's going to be awesome. And you can also find me right here on the network doing The Edge, which is our new podcast about Star Trek Discovery. and you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Norman C. Lau, Jeff Sutter, and Chris Steftenagel.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for your support. If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. So head on over there if you can help us out, and we would greatly appreciate it. Again, you'll find all the information at patreon.com/trekfm. All right, so that takes care of Domino. The first step in the evolution, you know, leading up to the look of Discovery, you know, I don't know. Was Discovery influenced by the look of the JJ films? A lot of people says it was. Who knows? Yeah. But whatever. I think more than anything, it's not like one leads to the other. It's sort of like a change in the approach to these things, you know, on the whole. And I don't know, it's exciting to see what Star Trek looks like now. So
I agree.
Yeah. So thanks for tuning in, and be sure to come back next week.